conversation, he would either deflect the attempt with a neutral comment or pass it along to the person involved. The day Murray left, everyone came to say goodbye. The sister seemed more relaxed. So did the father. The family mood was noticeably altered. A week later, Murray's mother sent him a letter that ended, "With all its ups and downs, your last trip home was the greatest ever." June now wrote regularly to his brother. The conflict over controlling the family business was diffused and settled. Murray's visits home now became things everyone looked forward to, even though he was still up to his old tricks with stories and such. Murray later wrote about the incident and incorporated what it had taught him into his training of other family therapists. He considered it the turning point in his career. Interpretation. Bowen's strategy in the experiment he conducted on his family was simple. He would make it impossible for any family member to make him take sides or hook him into any kind of alliance. He would also deliberately cause an emotional tempest to break up the stale family dynamic, particularly targeting June and his mother, that dynamic's centrifugal forces. He would make his family see things anew by getting them to talk about personal matters rather than avoiding them. He would work on himself to stay calm and rational, squelching any desire either to please or to run away from confrontation. And in the midst of this experiment, Bowen experienced an unbelievable feeling of lightness, a near euphoria. For the first time in his life, he felt connected to the family without being submerged by its emotional pulls. He could engage, argue, and banter without either regressing into childish tantrums or striving to be falsely agreeable. The more he dealt with the family this way, the easier it became. Bowen also noticed the effect his behavior had on others. First, they could not interact in their usual way. June could not avoid him. His weak sister could not internalize all the family's problems. The mother could not use him as a crutch. Next, they found themselves drawn to him. His refusal to take sides made it easier to open up to him. The stale family dynamic of gossip, secret communications, and irritating alliances was broken up in one visit. And, according to Bowen, it stayed that way for the rest of his life. Bowen transferred his theory and practice beyond the family. He thought about his workplace, which had a family-like group ego and emotional system that infected him every time he was there. People would pull him into alliances, criticize absent colleagues, make it impossible for him to stay detached. Avoiding these conversations solved nothing. It meant he was still affected by the group dynamic, just unable to deal with it. Listening patiently to people's gossip while wishing they would stop was equally frustrating. Bowen had to take some kind of action to disrupt the dynamic, and he found he could apply the same tactics he had used on his family to great success. He purposefully stirred things up while staying free of alliances. And, as with his family, he noticed the tremendous power his autonomy gave him in the group. No one can get far in life without allies. The trick, however, is to recognize the difference between false allies and real ones. A false alliance is created out of an immediate emotional need. It requires that you give up something essential about yourself and makes it impossible for you to make your own decisions. A true alliance is formed out of mutual self-interest, each side supplying what the other cannot get alone. It does not require you to fuse your own identity with that of a group or pay attention to everyone else's emotional needs. It allows you autonomy. Throughout your life, you will find yourself in groups that demand fusion, forcing you into all kinds of false alliances that command your emotions. You must find a way to the position of strength and power, able to interact and engage with people while staying autonomous. You deftly avoid false alliances by taking provocative actions that make it impossible for people to entrap you. You shake up the dynamic as much as possible, targeting the troublemakers and controllers. Once you are in a position where you are able to stay rational within the group, you can seem to join an alliance without worrying about your emotions running away with you. And you will find that as the person who is simultaneously autonomous and part of the group, you will become a center of gravity and attention. By Baltazar Gracian. Enter into action under the cover of helping another's interests, only to further your own in the end. This is the perfect stratagem and disguise for realizing your ambitions, for the advantages you seem to offer only serve as lures to influence the other person's will. They think their interests are being advanced, when in truth, they are opening the way for yours. Keys to Warfare. To survive and advance at all in life, we find ourselves constantly having to use other people for some purpose, some need, to obtain resources we cannot get on our own, to give us protection of some sort, to compensate for a skill or talent we do not possess. As a description of human relationships, however, the word use has ugly connotations, and in any case we always like to make our actions seem nobler than they are. We prefer to think of these interactions as relationships of assistance, partnering, friendship. This is not a matter of mere semantics. It is the source of a dangerous confusion that will harm you in the end. When you look for an ally, you have a need, an interest you want met. This is a practical, strategic matter upon which your success depends. If you allow emotions and appearances to infect the kinds of alliances you form, you are in danger. The art of forming alliances depends on your ability to separate friendship from need. The first step is to understand that all of us constantly use other people to help and advance ourselves. Bowen went so far as to use his own family in an experiment to solve a professional dilemma. There is no shame in this, no need to ever feel guilty. Nor should we take it personally when we realize that someone else is using us. Using people is a human and social necessity. Next, with this understanding in mind, you must learn to make these necessary alliances strategic ones, aligning yourself with people who can give you something you cannot get on your own. This requires that you resist the temptation to let your decisions about alliances be governed by your emotions. Your emotional needs are what your personal life is for, and you must leave them behind when you enter the arena of social battle. The alliances that will help you most are those involving mutual self-interest. Alliances infected with emotions, or with ties of loyalty and friendship, are nothing but trouble. Being strategic with your alliances will also keep you from the bad entanglements that are the undoing of so many. Think of your alliances as stepping stones toward a goal. Over the course of your life, you will be constantly jumping from one stone to the next to suit your needs. When this particular river is crossed, you will leave them behind you. We will call this constant shifting yet advancing use of allies the alliance game. Many key principles of the alliance game originated in ancient China, which was composed of numerous states in continual flux, now weak, now powerful, now weak again. War was a dangerous affair, for a state that invaded another would stir up a lot of mistrust among the others and would often find itself losing ground in the long run. Meanwhile, a state that remained too loyal to an ally might find itself pulled into a war from which it could not break free and would go down in the process. The formation of proper alliances was in some ways a more important art than that of warfare itself, and the statesmen adept at this art were more powerful than military leaders. It was through the alliance game that the state of Qin was able to slowly expand during the dangerous warring states period of 403 to 221 BC. Qin would make alliances with distant states and attack nearby ones. The nearby state that Qin had invaded could not get help from its outlying neighbor because that neighbor was now allied to Qin. If Qin faced an enemy that had a key ally, it would work first to disrupt the alliance, sowing dissension, spreading rumors, courting one of the two sides with money, until the alliance fell apart. Then, Qin would invade first one of the two states, then the other. Gradually, bit by bit, it gobbled up neighboring states, until in the late 3rd century BC, it was able to unify China, a remarkable feat. To play the alliance game right, today as in ancient China, you must be realistic to the core, thinking far ahead and keeping the situation as fluid as possible. The ally of today may be the enemy of tomorrow. Sentiment has no place in the picture. If you are weak but clever, you can slowly leapfrog into a position of strength by bouncing from one alliance to another. The opposite approach is to make a key alliance and stick with it, valuing trust and an established relationship. This can work well in stable times, but in periods of flux, which are more common, it can prove to be your undoing. Differences in interest will inevitably emerge, and at the same time it will become hard to disentangle yourself from a relationship in which so much emotion has been invested. It is safer to bank on change, to keep your options open and your alliances based on need, not loyalty or shared values. In the golden age of Hollywood, actresses had almost the least amount of power of anyone. Careers were short. Even a great star would be replaced in a few years by someone younger. An actress would stay loyal to her studio, then watch helplessly as the roles dried up. The actress who best bucked the trend was Joan Crawford, who played her own version of the alliance game. In 1933, for instance, she met the screenwriter Joseph Mankiewicz, then a timid young man just starting out on what would be an illustrious career. Crawford recognized his talent immediately and went out of her way to befriend him, much to his amazement. He went on to write 9 screenplays for her, greatly lengthening her career. Crawford would also court cameramen and photographers, who would then work overtime to light her well and make her look good. She might do the same with the producer, who controlled a screenplay with the role in it she coveted. Crawford would often make alliances with up-and-coming young talent who valued a relationship with the star. Then she would gracefully break or forget the connection when it no longer served her needs. Nor would she stay loyal to the studio, or indeed to anyone, only to herself. Her unsentimental approach to her own shifting network of alliances allowed her to avoid the trap that most actresses found embedded in the system. The key to playing the game is to recognize who can best advance your interests at that moment. This need not be the most obviously powerful person on the scene, the person who seems to be able to do most for you. Alliances that meet specific needs or answer particular deficiencies are often more useful. Grand alliances between two great powers are generally the least effective. Because Louis XI had a weak army, the Swiss, though minor players on the European scene, were the allies he needed. Recognizing this years in advance, he cultivated an alliance that bewildered his enemies. As an ambitious young congressional assistant in Washington, Lyndon Johnson realized he lacked all kinds of powers and talents to get him to the top. He became a clever user of other people's talents. Realizing the importance of information in Congress, he made a point of befriending and allying himself with those at key positions, whether high or low, in the information chain. He was particularly good with older men who enjoyed the company of a lively young man and the role of the father figure giving advice. Slowly, from being a poor kid from Texas with no connections, Johnson raised himself to the top through his network of convenient alliances. It is a common strategy in bicycle races not to go out in front, but to stay right behind the leader, a position that cuts down wind resistance. The leader faces the wind for you and saves you energy. At the last minute, you sprint ahead. Letting other people cut resistance for you and waste their energy on your behalf is the height of economy and strategy. One of the best stratagems in the alliance game is to begin by seeming to help another person in some cause or fight, only for the purpose of furthering your own interests in the end. It is easy to find such people. They have a glaring need, a temporary weakness that you can help them to overcome. Now you have put them under a subtle obligation to you, to use as you will, to dominate their affairs, to divert their energies in the direction you desire. The emotions you create with your offer of help will blind the other person to your ulterior purpose. The artist Salvador Dali was particularly adept at this version of the game. If someone needed to raise money, say, Dali would come to the rescue, organizing a charity ball or other fundraising event. The person in need could hardly resist. Dali was friendly with royalty, Hollywood stars, socialites. Soon he would be ordering all kinds of elaborate props for the ball. For his infamous Night in a Surrealist Forest in Pebble Beach, California in 1941, which was intended to benefit starving artists in war-torn Europe, Dali requested a live giraffe, enough pine trees to create a fake forest, the largest bed in the world, a wrecked automobile, and thousands of pairs of shoes from which to serve the first course. In the end, the party was a smash and got all kinds of publicity, but as so often with Dali, the bills far exceeded the receipts. No money was left over for the starving artists of Europe. And strangely enough, all of the publicity was focused on Dali, increasing his fame and winning him more powerful allies. A variation of the alliance game is to play the mediator, the center around which other powers pivot. While remaining covertly autonomous, you make those around you fight for your allegiance. This was essentially how Prince Clemens von Metternich, the Austrian foreign minister during the Napoleonic era and afterward, restored Austria as Europe's principal power. It helped that Austria is located in the center of Europe and so is strategically vital to the nations around it. Even during the reign of Napoleon, when Austria was at its weakest and Metternich had to cozy up to the French, he kept his country free of lasting entanglements. Without bonding Austria to France by any legal alliance, for example, he tied Napoleon to him emotionally by arranging for the emperor to marry into the Austrian royal family. Keeping all of the great powers, England, France, Russia, at arm's length, he made everything revolve around Austria, even though Austria itself was no longer a great military power. The brilliance of this variation is that merely by assuming a central position, you can wield tremendous power. For instance, you place yourself at a critical point in the information chain, giving you access to and control over it. Or you produce something other people depend on, giving you incredible leverage. Or you play the mediator everyone needs to resolve a dispute. Whatever it is, you can maintain power in this central position only by keeping yourself unentangled and courted by all. The moment you enter into any kind of lasting alliance, your power is greatly reduced. A key component of the alliance game is the ability to manipulate other people's alliances, and even destroy them, sowing dissension among your opponents so that they fight among themselves. Breaking your enemy's alliances is as good as making alliances yourself. When Hernan Cortes landed in Mexico in 1519, he faced hundreds of thousands of Aztecs with 500 men. Knowing that many smaller Mexican tribes resented the powerful Aztec Empire, he slowly worked to peel them away from their alliances with the Aztecs. By filling a tribal leader's ears with horrible stories about the Aztec emperor's plans, for example, he might bait the man into arresting the Aztec envoys on their next visit. That, of course, would infuriate the emperor, and now the tribe would be isolated and in danger, and would appeal to Cortes for protection. On and on Cortes went with this negative version of the alliance game, until the Aztecs' allies had become his. Your focus here is on stirring up mistrust. Make one partner suspicious of the other. Spread rumors. Cast doubts on people's motives. Be friendly to one ally to make the other jealous. Divide and conquer. In this way, you will create a tide of emotions, hitting first this side, then that, until the alliance totters. Now former members of the alliance will feel vulnerable. Through manipulation or outright invitation, make them turn to you for protection. In facing an enemy that is composed of allies, no matter how large or formidable, do not be afraid. As Napoleon said, "Give me allies to fight." In war, allies generally have problems of command and control. The worst kind of leadership is divided leadership. Compelled to debate and agree before they act, Allied generals usually move like snails. When fighting large groups of Allies, as he often did, Napoleon always attacked first the weak link, the junior partner. Collapse here could make the whole fabric of the alliance fall apart. He would also seek quick victory in battle, even a small one, for no force is more easily discouraged by a defeat than an Allied one. Finally, you will of course be attacked for playing the alliance game. People will accuse you of being feckless, amoral, treacherous. Remember, these charges are strategic themselves. They are part of a moral offensive. See chapter 25. To advance their own interests, your accusers are trying to make you feel guilty or look bad. Do not let them get to you. The only real danger is that your reputation will eventually keep people from making alliances with you. But self-interest rules the world. If you are seen to have benefited others in the past and is capable of doing the same in the present, you will have suitors and playing partners. Besides, you are loyal and generous as long as there is mutual need. And when you show that you cannot be had by the false lure of permanent loyalty and friendship, you will actually find yourself treated with greater respect. Many will be drawn to your realistic and spirited way of playing the game. Reversal. If you play the alliance game, so will those around you, and you cannot take their behavior personally. You must keep dealing with them. But there are some types with whom any kind of alliance will harm you. You can often recognize them by their over-eagerness to pursue you. They will make the first move, trying to blind you with alluring offers and glittering promises. To protect yourself from being used in a negative way, always look at the tangible benefits you will gain from this alliance. If the benefits seem vague or hard to realize, think twice about joining forces. Look at your prospective allies' past for signs of greed or of using people without giving in return. Be wary of people who speak well, have apparently charming personalities, and talk about friendship, loyalty, and selflessness. They are most often con artists trying to prey on your emotions. Keep your eye on the interests involved on both sides and never let yourself be distracted from them. Here are further reflections on the alliance strategy. From Aesop's Fables. The Dog, the Cock, and the Fox. A dog and a cockerel, having made friends, were strolling along a road together. As evening fell, the cockerel flew up into a tree to sleep there, and the dog went to sleep at the foot of the tree, which was hollow. According to his habit, the cockerel crowed just before daybreak. This alerted a fox nearby, who ran up to the tree and called up to the cockerel, "Do come down, sir, for I dearly wish to embrace a creature who could have such a beautiful voice as you." The cockerel said, "I shall come down as soon as you awaken the doorkeeper who is asleep at the foot of the tree." Then, as the fox went to look for the doorkeeper, the dog pounced briskly on him and tore him to pieces. This fable teaches us that sensible men, when their enemies attack them, divert them to someone better able to defend them than they are themselves. From The Discourses by Niccolò Machiavelli. Since in all her decisions, whether by chance or by choice, Rome took all steps necessary to make herself great, she did not overlook fraud. She could not at the start have been more deceitful than she was in the means she took, as we were saying just now, to acquire allies, since under this title she made them all her servants, as was the case with the Latins and other peoples round about. For she first availed herself of their arms in order to subjugate neighboring peoples, and to build up her reputation as a state, and then having subdued them, she increased to such an extent that she could beat anyone. Nor would the Latins ever have realized that in reality they were mere slaves if they had not seen the Samnites twice defeated and forced to accept Rome's terms. From the I Ching. Six in the third place means He finds a comrade. Now he beats the drum. Now he stops. Now he sobs. Now he sings. Here the source of a man's strength lies not in himself, but in his relation to other people. No matter how close to them he may be, if his center of gravity depends on them, he is inevitably tossed to and fro between joy and sorrow. Rejoicing to high heaven, then sad unto death. This is the fate of those who depend upon an inner accord with other persons whom they love. From Aesop's Fables. The Fox and the Billy Goat. A fox, having fallen into a well, was faced with the prospect of being stuck there. But then a billy goat came along to that same well because he was thirsty and saw the fox. He asked him if the water was good. The fox decided to put a brave face on it and gave a tremendous speech about how wonderful the water was down there, so very excellent. So the billy goat climbed down the well, thinking only of his thirst. When he had a good drink, he asked the fox what he thought was the best way to get back up again. The fox said, "Well, I have a very good way to do that. Of course, it will mean our working together. If you just push your front feet up against the wall and hold your horns up in the air as high as you can, I will climb up onto them, get out, and then I can pull you up behind me." The billy goat willingly consented to this idea, and the fox briskly clambered up the legs, the shoulders, and finally the horns of his companion. He found himself at the mouth of the well, pulled himself out, and immediately scampered off. The billy goat shouted after him, reproaching him for breaking their agreement of mutual assistance. From the Greek Myths by Robert Graves. Heracles had performed these 10 labors in the space of 8 years and 1 month. But Eurystheus, discounting the second and the fifth, set him 2 more. The 11th labor was to fetch fruit from the golden apple tree, Mother Earth's wedding gift to Hera, with which she had been so delighted that she planted it in her own divine garden. This garden lay on the slopes of Mount Atlas, where the panting chariot horses of the sun complete their journey, and where Atlas's sheep and cattle, 1,000 herds of each, wander over their undisputed pastures. When Hera found one day that Atlas's daughters, the Hesperides, to whom she had entrusted the tree, were pilfering the apples, she set the ever-watchful dragon Ladon to coil around the tree as its guardian. When at last Heracles came to the Po, the river nymphs, daughters of Zeus and Themis, showed him Nereus asleep. He seized the hoary old sea god, and clinging to him despite his many protean changes, forced him to prophesy how the golden apples could be won. Nereus had advised Heracles not to pluck the apples himself, but to employ Atlas as his agent, meanwhile relieving him of his fantastic burden. Therefore, on arriving at the garden of the Hesperides, he asked Atlas to do him this favor. Atlas would have undertaken almost any task for the sake of an hour's respite, but he feared Ladon, whom Heracles thereupon killed with an arrow shot over the garden wall. Heracles now bent his back to receive the weight of the celestial globe, and Atlas walked away, returning presently with 3 apples plucked by his daughters. He found the sense of freedom delicious. "I will take these apples to Eurystheus myself without fail," he said, "if you hold up the heavens for a few moments longer." Heracles pretended to agree, but having been warned by Nereus not to accept any such offer, begged Atlas to support the globe for only 1 moment more, while he put a pad on his head. Atlas, easily deceived, laid the apples on the ground and resumed his burden, whereupon Heracles picked them up and went away with an ironical farewell. From The Secret Life of Salvador Dali by Salvador Dali. I regarded most of the people I met solely and exclusively as creatures I could use as porters in my voyages of ambition. Almost all these porters sooner or later became exhausted. Unable to endure the long marches that I forced on them at top speed and under all climatic conditions, They died on the way. I took others. To attach them to my service, I promised to get them to where I myself was going, to that end station of glory which climbers desperately want to reach. From Aesop's Fables. The Lion and the Wild Ass. A lion and a wild ass entered into an agreement to hunt wild beasts together. The lion was to use his great strength, while the ass would make use of his greater speed. When they had taken a certain number of animals, the lion divided up the spoils into three portions. "I'll take the first share because I am the king," he said. "The second share will be mine, because I have been your partner in the chase," he said. "As for the third share," he said to the wild ass, "this share will be a great source of harm to you, believe me, if you do not yield it up to me. And by the way, get lost." It is suitable always to calculate your own strength, and not to enter into an alliance with people stronger than yourself. And lastly, from The Wiles of War, 36 Military Strategies from Ancient China. The state of Jin, located in modern Shanxi, grew steadily in strength by swallowing small neighbors. There were two small states, Hu and Yu, to its south. In the spring of the 19th year under King Hui of Zhou, 658 BC, Duke Xian of Jin sent for a trusted minister, Shun Shi, and declared his intention to attack Hu. "We have little chance to gain advantage," observed Shun Shi after a pause. "Hu and Yu have always been very close. When we attack one of them, the other will surely come to its rescue. Pitched 1-1, neither of them is our match, but the result is far from certain if we fight both of them at the same time." "Surely you are not saying we have no way to cope with these two small states?" asked the duke. Shun Shi thought for a while before replying. "I have thought up a plan by which we will be able to subdue both Hu and Yu. For the first step, we should present the Duke of Yu with handsome gifts, and ask him to lend us a path by which we can attack Hu." The duke asked, "But we have just offered gifts to Hu and signed a friendly agreement with it. We can hardly make Yu believe that we want to attack Hu instead of Yu itself." "That is not so difficult to work out," replied Shun Shi. "We may secretly order our men on the border to make raids on Hu. When the men of Hu come to protest, we may use that as a pretext to attack them. In this way, you will be convinced of our professed intention." The duke considered it a good plan. Before long, armed conflicts broke out along the Jin-Hu border to the south. Thereupon the duke asked, "Now we have good reason to convince you of our intention to attack Hu. But it will not lend the path to us unless it receives a good profit in return. So what shall we use to bribe the Duke of Yu?" Shun Shi replied, "Though the Duke of Yu is known to be very greedy, he will not be moved unless our gifts are extremely precious. So why not offer him fine horses from Kyu and jade from Chuji?" The duke looked reluctant. "But these are the best treasures I have. I can hardly bring myself to part with them." "I am not surprised by your doubts," said Shun Shi. "Nevertheless, we are bound to subdue Hu now that it has lost the shield of Yu. After Hu is conquered, Yu will not be able to survive on its own. Therefore, when you send these gifts to the Duke of Yu, you are simply consigning the jade to your external mansion and the horses to your external stable." When Shun Shi was ushered into the court of Yu and presented the gifts, the Duke of Yu's eyes bulged. "The men of Hu have repeatedly worked up disturbances along our border," said Shun Shi. "To protect our people from the calamity of war, we have exerted the highest restraint and concluded a peace treaty with Hu. Nevertheless, the impudent Hu takes our restraint for weakness and is now creating new troubles by making invidious charges against us. Therefore, my lord was compelled to order a punitive expedition against Hu, and he dispatched me to ask your permission to let our troops pass through your land. This way we can get around our border with Hu, where its defense is strong, and launch a surprise attack at its weak point. When we have defeated the men of Hu, we shall present you with splendid trophies to testify to our mutual alliance and friendship." That summer, the Jin troops attacked Hu by way of Yu. The Duke of Yu led a band of force in person to join in the expedition. They defeated the Hu army and captured Zhaoyang, one of Hu's two major cities. The Duke of Yu received his share of the booty and believed he had nothing to regret for. In autumn of the 22nd year, under King Hui of Zhou, 655 BC, the Duke of Jin again sent an envoy to borrow a path from Yu to Hu, and again the Duke of Yu gave his consent. In the 8th month, the Duke of Jin led 600 war chariots and proceeded by way of Yu to attack Hu. They laid siege to Shangyang, the capital of Hu. The city, after holding out for nearly 4 months, finally yielded. The Duke of Hu fled, and Hu, as a feudal state, was destroyed. On their way back, the Jin troops halted at Yu. The Duke of Yu came to welcome them, receiving the Duke of Jin into the capital. The Jin troops seized the chance to storm into the city. Taken totally off guard, the Yu army submitted with little resistance, and the Duke of Yu was taken prisoner. Duke Xian of Jin was extremely pleased when Shun Shi returned to present him with the horses and jade as well as the captured Duke of Yu. Chapter 28. Give your rivals enough rope to hang themselves. The one-upmanship strategy. Life's greatest dangers often come not from external enemies, but from our supposed colleagues and friends who pretend to work for the common cause while scheming to sabotage us and steal our ideas for their gain. Although in the court in which you serve you must maintain the appearance of consideration and civility, you also must learn to defeat these people. Work to instill doubts and insecurities in such rivals, getting them to think too much and act defensively. Bait them with subtle challenges that get under their skin, triggering an overreaction, an embarrassing mistake. The victory you are after is to isolate them. Make them hang themselves through their own self-destructive tendencies, leaving you blameless and clean. The Art of One-Upmanship. Throughout your life, you will find yourself fighting on two fronts. First is the external front, your inevitable enemies. But second, and less obvious, is the internal front, your colleagues and fellow courtiers, many of whom will scheme against you, advancing their own agendas at your expense. The worst of it is that you will often have to fight on both fronts at once, facing your external enemies while also working to secure your internal position, an exhausting and debilitating struggle. The solution is not to ignore the internal problem, you will have a short life if you do so, or to deal with it in a direct and conventional manner by complaining, acting aggressively, or forming defensive alliances. Understand, internal warfare is by nature unconventional. Since people theoretically on the same side usually do their best to maintain the appearance of being team players working for the greater good, complaining about them or attacking them will only make you look bad and isolate you. Yet at the same time, you can expect these ambitious types to operate underhandedly and indirectly. Outwardly charming and cooperative, behind the scenes, they are manipulative and slippery. You need to adopt a form of warfare suited to these nebulous yet dangerous battles, which go on every day. And the unconventional strategy that works best in this arena is the art of one-upmanship. Developed by history's savviest courtiers, it is based on two simple premises. First, your rivals harbor the seeds of their own self-destruction. And second, a rival who is made to feel defensive and inferior, however subtly, will tend to act defensive and inferior to his or her detriment. People's personalities often form around weaknesses, character flaws, uncontrollable emotions. People who feel needy, or who have a superiority complex, or are afraid of chaos, or desperately want order, will develop a personality, a social mask, to cover up their flaws and make it possible for them to present a confident, pleasant, responsible exterior to the world. But the mask is like the scar tissue covering a wound. Touch it the wrong way, and it hurts. Your victim's responses start to go out of control. They complain, act defensive and paranoid, or show the arrogance they try so hard to conceal. For a moment, the mask falls. When you sense you have colleagues who may prove dangerous, or are actually already plotting something, you must try first to gather intelligence on them. Look at their everyday behavior, their past actions, their mistakes, for signs of their flaws. With this knowledge in hand, you are ready for the game of one-upmanship. Begin by doing something to prick the underlying wound, creating doubt, insecurity, and anxiety. It might be an offhand comment or something that your victim senses as a challenge to their position within the court. Your goal is not to challenge them blatantly, though, but to get under their skin. They feel attacked but are not sure why or how. The result is a vague, troubling sensation. A feeling of inferiority creeps in. You then follow up with secondary actions that feed their doubts. Here, it is often best to work covertly, getting other people, the media, or simple rumor to do the job for you. The end game is deceptively simple. Having piled up enough self-doubt to trigger a reaction, you stand back and let the target self-destruct. You must avoid the temptation to gloat or get in a last blow. At this point, in fact, it is best to act friendly, even offering dubious assistance and advice. Your target's reaction will be an overreaction. Either they will lash out, make an embarrassing mistake, or reveal themselves too much, or they will get overly defensive and try too hard to please others, working all too obviously to secure their position and validate their self-esteem. Defensive people unconsciously push people away. At this point, your opening action, especially if it is only subtly aggressive, will be forgotten. What will stand out will be your rival's overreaction and humiliation. Your hands are clean, your reputation unsullied. Their loss of position is your gain. You are one up and they are one down. If you had attacked them directly, your advantage would be temporary or non-existent. In fact, your political position would be precarious. Your pathetic, suffering rivals would win sympathy as your victims, and attention would focus on you as responsible for their undoing. Instead, they must fall on their swords. You may have given them a little help, but to whatever extent possible in their own eyes, and certainly in everyone else's, they must have only themselves to blame. That will make their defeat doubly galling and doubly effective. To win without your victims knowing how it happened, or just what you have done, is the height of unconventional warfare. Master the art, and not only will you find it easier to fight on two fronts at the same time, but your path to the highest ranks will be that much smoother. By Napoleon Bonaparte. Never interfere with an enemy that is in the process of committing suicide. Historical examples. 1. John A. McClernand, 1812 to 1900, watched with envy as his friend and fellow lawyer Abraham Lincoln rose to the U.S. presidency. McClernand, a lawyer and congressman from Springfield, Illinois, had had this ambition himself. Shortly after the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861, he resigned his congressional seat to accept a commission as a brigadier general in the Union Army. He had no military experience, but the Union needed leadership of any kind it could get, and if he proved himself in battle, he could rise fast. He saw this army position as his path to the presidency. McClernand's first post was at the head of a brigade in Missouri, under the overall command of General Ulysses S. Grant. Within a year, he was promoted to Major General, still under Grant. But this was not good enough for McClernand, who needed a stage for his talents, a campaign to run and get credit for. Grant had talked to him of his plans for capturing the Confederate fort at Vicksburg on the Mississippi River. The fall of Vicksburg, according to Grant, could be the turning point in the war. McClernand decided to sell a march on Vicksburg as his own idea and use it as a springboard for his career. In September 1862, on leave in Washington, D.C., McClernand paid a visit to President Lincoln. He was tired of furnishing brains for Grant's army, he said. He had proved himself on the battlefield and was a better strategist than Grant, who was a little too fond of his whiskey. McClernand proposed to go back to Illinois, where he was well known and could recruit a large army. Then he would follow the Mississippi River south to Vicksburg and capture the fort. Vicksburg was technically in Grant's department, but Lincoln was not sure the general could lead the audacious attack necessary. He took McClernand to see Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, another former lawyer, who commiserated with his two visitors on the difficulties of dealing with military brass. Stanton listened to and liked McClernand's plan. That October, the one-time congressman left Washington with confidential orders giving him approval for his march on Vicksburg. The orders were a little vague, and Grant was not informed of them, but McClernand would make the best of them. McClernand quickly recruited more soldiers than he had promised Lincoln he would. He sent his recruits to Memphis, Tennessee, where he would soon join them to march on Vicksburg. But when he arrived in Memphis in late December 1862, the thousands of men he had recruited were not there. A telegram from Grant, dated 10 days earlier and waiting for him in Memphis, informed him that the general was planning to attack Vicksburg. If McClernand arrived in time, he would lead the attack. If not, his men would be led by General William Tecumseh Sherman. McClernand was livid. The situation had clearly been orchestrated to make it impossible for him to arrive in time to lead his own recruits. Grant must have figured out his plan. The general's polite telegram covering his bases made the whole affair doubly infuriating. Well, McClernand would show him. He would hurry downriver, catch up with Sherman, take over the campaign, and humiliate Grant by winning the credit and honor for capturing Vicksburg. McClernand did catch up with Sherman on January 2, 1863, and immediately assumed command of the army. He made an effort to be charming to Sherman, who, he learned, had been planning to raid Confederate outposts around Vicksburg to soften up the approach to the fort. The idea was heaven-sent for McClernand. He would take over these raids, win battles without Grant's name over his, earn himself some publicity, and make his command of the Vicksburg campaign a fait accompli. He followed Sherman's plan to the letter, and the campaign was a success. At this triumphant point, out of the blue, McClernand received a telegram from Grant. He was to halt operations and wait for a meeting with the general. It was time for McClernand to play his trump card, the president. He wrote Lincoln, requesting more explicit orders, and specifically an independent command. But he got no reply. And now vague doubts began to trouble McClernand's peace of mind. Sherman and other officers seemed cool. Somehow he had rubbed them the wrong way. Perhaps they were conspiring with Grant to get rid of him. Grant soon appeared on the scene with detailed plans for a campaign against Vicksburg under his own direction. McClernand would lead a corps which, however, was stationed at the faraway outpost of Helena, Arkansas. Grant made a point of treating him politely, but everything together added up to a humiliating setback. Now McClernand exploded, writing letter after letter to Lincoln and Stanton to remind them of their earlier rapport and of the support they had once given him, and complaining bitterly about Grant. After days of fuming and writing, McClernand finally received a response from Lincoln. And to his shock and dismay, the president had somehow turned against him. There had been too many family quarrels among his generals, wrote Lincoln. For the sake of the Union cause, McClernand should subordinate himself to Grant. McClernand was crushed. He could not figure out what he had done or how it had all gone wrong. Bitter and frustrated, he continued to serve under Grant, but questioned his boss's abilities to anyone who would listen, including journalists. In June 1863, after enough negative articles had been printed, Grant finally fired him. McClernand's military career was over, and with it his dreams of personal glory. Interpretation. From the moment he met John McClernand, General Grant knew he had a troublemaker on his hands. McClernand was the type of man who thought only of his own career, who would steal other people's ideas and plot behind their backs for the sake of personal glory. But Grant would have to be careful. McClernand was popular with the public, a charmer. So when Grant figured out on his own that McClernand was trying to beat him to Vicksburg, he did not confront him or complain. Instead, he took action. Knowing that McClernand had an oversensitive ego, Grant recognized that it would be relatively easy to push the man's buttons. By taking over his subordinates' recruits, technically in his department anyway, while apparently covering his bases in the telegram, he forced McClernand into a rash response that seemed like insubordination to other military men and made it clear how far he was using the war for personal purposes. Once McClernand had rushed to take his troops back from Sherman, Grant stood aside. He knew that a man like this, vain and obnoxious, would irritate the hell out of his brother officers. They would inevitably complain about him to Grant, who, as a responsible officer, would have to pass the complaints upward, apparently without personal feelings in play. Treating McClernand politely while indirectly checkmating him, Grant finally got him to overreact in the worst possible way, with his letters to Lincoln and Stanton. Grant knew that Lincoln was tired of squabbling within the Union high command. While Grant could be seen working quietly to perfect his plans for taking Vicksburg, McClernand was acting petty and throwing tantrums. The difference between the two men was all too clear. With this battle won, Grant repeated it, letting McClernand hang himself with his unwise complaints to the press. You will often come across McClernands in your daily battles, people who are outwardly charming but treacherous behind the scenes. It does no good to confront them directly. They are proficient at the political game. But a subtle one-up campaign can work wonders. Your goal is to get these rivals to put their ambition and selfishness on display. The way to do this is to pique their latent but powerful insecurities. Make them worry that people do not like them, that their position is unstable, that their path to the top is not clear. Perhaps, like Grant, you can take action that thwarts their plan in some way while hiding your own beneath a veneer of politeness. You are making them feel defensive and disrespected. All the dark, ugly emotions they strive so hard to hide will boil up to the surface. They will tend to lash out, overplaying their hand. Work to make them grow emotional and lose their habitual cool. The more they reveal of themselves, the more they will alienate other people, and isolation will be their doom. 2. The Académie Française, founded by Cardinal Richelieu in 1635, is a highly select body of France's 40 most learned scholars, whose task it is to oversee the purity of the French language. It was customary in the early years of the Academy that when a seat became empty, potential members would petition to fill it. But on the occasion of a vacant seat in 1694, King Louis XIV decided to go against protocol and nominated the Bishop of Noyon. Louis's nomination certainly made sense. The bishop was a learned man, well-respected, an excellent orator, and a fine writer. The bishop, however, had another quality as well, an incredible sense of self-importance. Louis was amused by this failing, but most in the court found it downright insufferable. The bishop had a way of making almost everyone feel inferior, in piety, erudition, family pedigree, whatever they had. Because of his rank, for instance, the bishop was accorded the rare privilege of being able to have his coach drive up to the front door of the royal residence, while most others had to get out and walk from the entrance doors of the driveway. One time the Archbishop of Paris was walking along the driveway when the Bishop of Noyon passed. From his carriage, the bishop waved and signaled for the archbishop to approach him. The archbishop expected him to alight and accompany him to the palace on foot. Instead, Noyon had the carriage slow down and continued his drive to the front door, leading the archbishop through the window by the arm, as if he were a dog on a leash, meanwhile chatting away superciliously. Then, once the bishop did get out of the carriage and the two men started up the grand staircase, Noyon dropped the archbishop as if he were nobody. Almost everyone in the court had a story like this one to tell, and they all nursed secret grudges against the bishop. With Louis's approval, however, it was impossible not to vote Noyon into the academy. The king further insisted that his courtiers attend the inauguration of the bishop, since this was his first nominee to the illustrious institution. At the inauguration, customarily, the nominee would deliver a speech, which would be answered by the academy's director, who at the time was a bold and witty man called the Abbé de Coubertin. The abbé could not stand the bishop, but particularly disliked his florid style of writing. De Coubertin conceived the idea of subtly mocking Noyon. He would compose his response in perfect imitation of the bishop, full of elaborate metaphors and gushing praise for the newest academician. To make sure he could not get into trouble for this, he would show his speech to the bishop beforehand. Noyon was delighted, read the text with great interest, and even went so far as to supplement it with more effusive words of praise and high-flying rhetoric. On the day of the inauguration, the hall of the academy was packed with the most eminent members of French society. None dared incur the king's displeasure by not attending. The bishop appeared before them, monstrously pleased to command this prestigious audience. The speech he delivered had a flowery pomposity exceeding any he had given previously. It was tiresome in the extreme. Then came the abbé's response. It started slowly, and many listeners began to squirm. But then it gradually took off, as everyone realized that it was an elaborate yet subtle parody of the bishop's style. De Coubertin's bold satire captivated everyone, and when it was over, the audience applauded, loudly and gratefully. But the bishop, intoxicated by the event and the attention, thought that the applause was genuine, and that in applauding the abbé's praise of him, the audience was really applauding him. He left with his vanity inflated beyond all proportion. Soon, Noyon was talking about the event to one and all, boring everyone to tears. Finally, he had the misfortune to brag about it to the Archbishop of Paris, who had never gotten over the carriage incident. The Archbishop could not resist. He told Noyon that the abbé's speech was a joke on him, and that everyone in the court was laughing at the bishop's expense. Noyon could not believe this, so he visited his friend and confessor, Père Lachaise, who confirmed that it was true. Now the bishop's former delight turned to the most bitter rage. He complained to the king and asked him to punish the abbé. The king tried to defuse the problem, but he valued peace and quiet, and Noyon's almost insane anger got on his nerves. Finally, the bishop, wounded to the core, left the court and returned to his diocese, where he remained for a long time, humiliated and humbled. Interpretation. The Bishop of Noyon was not a harmless man. His conceit had made him think his power had no limits. He was grossly unaware of the offense he had given to so many people, but no one could confront him or bring his behavior to his attention. The abbé hit upon the only real way to bring such a man down. Had his parody been too obvious, it would not have been very entertaining, and the bishop, its poor victim, would have won sympathy. By making it devilishly subtle, and making the bishop complicit in it as well, de Coubertin both entertained the court, always important, and let Noyon dig his own grave with his reaction, from the heights of vanity to the depths of humiliation and rage. Suddenly aware of how people saw him, the bishop lost his balance, even alienating the king, who had once found his vanity amusing. Finally, he had to absent himself from court, to many people's relief. The worst colleagues and comrades are often the ones with inflated egos, who think everything they do is right and worthy of praise. Subtle mockery and disguised parody are brilliant ways of one-upping these types. You seem to be complimenting them, your style or ideas even imitating theirs, but the praise has a sting in its tail. Are you imitating them to poke fun at them? Does your praise hide criticism? These questions get under their skin, making them vaguely insecure about themselves. Maybe you think they have faults, and maybe that opinion is widely shared. You have disturbed their high sense of self, and they will tend to respond by overreacting and overplaying their hand. This strategy works particularly well on those who fancy themselves powerful intellectuals and who are impossible to best in any kind of argument. By quoting their words and ideas back at them in slightly grotesque form, you neutralize their verbal strengths and leave them self-doubting and insecure. 3. Toward the middle of the 16th century, a young samurai, whose name history has left behind, developed a novel way of fighting. He could wield two swords with equal dexterity in his right and left hands at the same time. This technique was formidable, and he was eager to use it to make a name for himself. So he decided to challenge the most famous swordsman of his time, Tsukahara Bokuden, to a duel. Bokuden was now middle-aged and in semi-retirement. He answered the young man's challenge with a letter. A samurai who could use a sword in his left hand with the same effectiveness as his right had an unfair advantage. The young swordsman could not understand what he meant. "If you think my using a sword with my left is unfair," he wrote back, "renounce the match." Instead, Bokuden sent off 10 more letters, each repeating, in slightly different words, the charge about the left hand. Each letter only made the challenger more annoyed. Finally, however, Bokuden agreed to fight. The young samurai was used to fighting on instinct and with great speed, but as the duel began, he could not stop thinking about his left hand and Bokuden's fear of it. With his left hand, he found himself calculating, he would stab here, slash there. His left hand could not fail. It seemed possessed of its own power. Then suddenly, out of nowhere, Bokuden's sword cut deeply across the challenger's right arm. The duel was over. The young samurai recovered physically, but his mind was forever unhinged. He could not fight by instinct anymore. He thought too much, and he soon gave up the sword. In 1605, Genzaimon, head of the renowned Yoshioka family of Kyoto swordsmen, received the strangest challenge of his life. An unknown 21-year-old samurai named Miyamoto Musashi, dressed like a beggar in dirty, ragged clothes, challenged him to a duel so haughtily that Musashi must have thought himself the more famous swordsman. Genzaimon did not feel he had to pay attention to this youth. A man as illustrious as he could not go through life accepting challenges from every bumpkin who crossed his path. Yet something about Musashi's arrogance got under his skin. Genzaimon would enjoy teaching this youth a lesson. The duel was set for 5 o'clock the following morning in a suburban field. Genzaimon arrived at the appointed time, accompanied by his students. Musashi was not there. Minutes turned into an hour. The young man had probably gotten cold feet and skipped town. Genzaimon sent a student to look for the young samurai at the inn where he was staying. The student soon returned. Musashi, he reported, had been asleep when he arrived, and when awakened, had rather impertinently ordered him to send Genzaimon his regards and say he would be there shortly. Genzaimon was furious and began to pace the field, and Musashi still took his time. It was 2 more hours before he appeared in the distance, sauntering toward them across the field. He was wearing, too, a scarlet headband, not the traditional white headband that Genzaimon wore. Genzaimon shouted angrily at Musashi and charged forward, impatient to have done with this irritating boor. But Musashi, looking almost bored, parried one blow after another. Each man was able to slash at the other's forehead, but where Genzaimon's white headband turned red with blood, Musashi's stayed the same color. Finally, frustrated and confused, Genzaimon charged forward yet again, right into Musashi's sword, which struck his head and knocked him to the ground unconscious. Genzaimon would later recover, but he was so humiliated by his defeat that he left the world of swordsmanship and entered the priesthood, where he would spend his remaining years. Interpretation. For a samurai, losing a duel could mean death or public humiliation. Swordsmen sought out any advantage, physical dexterity, a superior sword, the perfect technique, to avoid that fate. But the greatest samurais, the Bokudens and Musashis, sought their advantage in being able to subtly push the opponent off his game, messing with his mind. They might try to make him self-conscious, a little too aware of his technique and style. A deadly trap for anyone who must react in the moment. They might trick him into focusing on the wrong thing. The left hand, the scarlet headband. Particularly with conventional-minded opponents, they might show up late, sparking a frustration that would upset their timing and concentration. In all of these cases, a change in the enemy's focus or mood would lead to a mistake. To try to repair this mistake in the heat of the moment would lead to another, until the one-upped fighter might literally walk into the other man's sword. Understand, what will yield the greatest effects in the game of one-upmanship is a subtle disturbance in your opponent's mood and mindset. Be too direct, make an insulting comment, an obvious threat, and you wake them to the danger you represent, stir their competitive juices, bring out the best.